Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Well, we can't control randomness. We can control either the box that it sits in, right? Or we can control the way that it flows through a system. And so if we know more people, if we connect with more people, and if more people know what we need help with, and we ask for it in a way that's easy, the probability of the impossible happening in our lives goes through the roof.
Why did I become an executive coach? I saw lots of great people fail to get ahead at work, while their much less talented peers blew right past them. That made me furious, but also curious. What were great people getting wrong? It came down to helping them re-examine what drove success and then helping them make critical shifts, one hard truth at a time.
Feel like you're doing everything you were told, but you're not moving ahead at work nor having the impact you seek? Then welcome to 97% Effective with Michael Winderoth, where we skip feel-good, happy talk and engage experts in pointed conversations about what it really takes to move the needle at work and your career. So if you feel stalled or frustrated or seek that extra edge as you move to the next level, then look no further. This is the Hard Truths Playbook you never got.
Hi, I'm Michael Winderoth, and you're listening to 97% Effective. When it comes to accelerating your career, increasing your impact, generating successful outcomes, there's a key ingredient that no one likes to admit or even talk about. And that ingredient is luck. Yes, the hard truth. While there is much we can control or influence to impact our destiny, there are some things, well, like luck, that we can't. Or can we? My guest today wants you to rethink your assumptions about luck. Can you generate more luck in your life? If so, how? Luck isn't chance, it's a choice. So says my guest today, Jonathan Brill, who Forbes named the number one business futurist. So listen in, a great conversation ahead. As Jonathan writes, and I love this as well, why sit and watch your future happen when you can take a hand in architecting it? Jonathan Brill is a keynote speaker, transformation architect, and the author of the bestseller Rogue Waves, Future-Proof Your Business to Survive and Profit from Radical Change. He inspires and helps the who's who of top companies navigate uncertainty and disruption so they come out riding rogue waves, not getting crushed by them. His thought leadership has appeared in Harvard Business Review, TED Talks, the Global Peter Drucker Forum, and much more. Jonathan started his career in industrial design. I really want to talk about that. From the Pratt Institute, spent years as a research consultant at the MIT Media Lab, and has worked as the global futurist at HP, Hewlett Packard, which led Inc. magazine to call him a Silicon Valley legend. So I'm super excited to have him on today. We're going to start talking about serendipity salons. Serendipity salons. And how you should think about those to generate more luck in your life and career. Jonathan, welcome to 97% Effective. Excited to have you on.
I'm really excited to be here. I just discovered how I believe we first met, which is stunning. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Well, we have multiple things in common, right? Between China, Silicon Valley, innovation, Stanford, and an amazing person, Dory Clark. But it was this serendipity salon. You'd been on my radar and your book is amazing. And this serendipity salon that you orchestrated in Barcelona that I actually missed, but the whole lead up to it and thinking about it and looking how you designed it really compelled me. And it has a huge overlap in my work with individuals. So that's the many connections that I saw. We've been meaning to meet face to face. We have never done that. And this still isn't. But I mean, you tell me how the connection first occurred.
Yeah. So I've kind of known about you and the radar as well. And I realized, you know, the first 30 years or so of my life, I thought I needed to be invited into things. And then I realized maybe 5 years ago that, no, there's a whole bunch of people sitting at their house with nothing better to do than have a drink with you. And by the way, they would like to meet 20 new friends who are the kind of people that would like to have a drink with me. And so what I do when I travel is I find people who are tangentially associated with me and I invite them to dinner. And so I was in Barcelona with my colleague, Nikki, and we started doing that. We said, who do we know in the country? And let's just have them to dinner. And we had 20 people to this townhouse in Barcelona, and the landlord came and he was like, oh my gosh, this is the most amazing thing. And I want to have this happen again. Can you do another one at my house in Barcelona? Let's be really clear about what happened. A guy on Airbnb said, no, I want you to throw more parties at my house. And here's why. Here's why this is fascinating. Because I believe that the people we know, like, closely, they have the same problems we have. They have the same social networks we have. But if you find somebody who's tangentially connected, or maybe it's someone you worked with 20 years ago that you like, and you reconnect with them, they've built a totally different social network. And so the things that are impossible to unlock in our own lives are often really easy for someone else, right? It's a phone call. I was on the secret island, like literally, this weekend with a number of pretty powerful people. And it was literally because 25 years ago, I put out a note on something called Craigslist saying, hey, I want to race boats. And this guy called me up and he said, there's a guy, you know, there's someone who can't make it this week, you know, tonight. Can you be there in 2 hours? 25 years ago, I met this guy. He invited me 25 years later to the secret island. And I'm helping out this company as this energy company, a smart energy company. And we haven't figured out how to break through to the people we need to break through to. So I'm on the secret island and I'm hanging out with this guy and we're having a drink. And I suddenly realized, no, this is the person who knows everybody else we need to know. And so I said, hey, can you make an introduction? And he says, sure. The reality is that luck isn't chance. It's a choice. And while we can't control randomness, we can control either the box that it sits in, right? Or we can control the way that it flows through a system. And so if we know more people, if we connect with more people, and if more people know what we need help with, and we ask for it in a way that's easy, the probability of the impossible happening in our lives goes through the roof. The opportunity I'm talking about that happened over the weekend was 100% a result of my putting a ripple out into the world 25 years ago. That's how it works. It's not predictable in the way most of us think about predictability and we want to do it in businesses, but it's remarkably reliable. That was a huge change in my life, a huge discovery in my life. And the fact that we're here having this conversation today is a result of doing the exact same thing. Instead of looking for help in this case, offering an opportunity to hang out and have a good time. So when we host serendipity salons, that's what they're really about. Bringing people who would be interesting but don't know each other from different fields, different socioeconomic groups, different geographies, hopefully, together to have a conversation about what they're looking for, what they're trying to achieve. And it's not like some facilitated, like, mastermindy thing. It's like, let's have a drink and just write up on the wall what we're looking for so that instead of the three people we know in the room knowing what our problem is, everybody does. Changes the dynamics, changes the shape of the network, and it dramatically increases potential. And we've seen really radical shifts in outcomes as a result of this, that people walk into a cocktail party and, you know, often, like, you know, 70-75% of them actually get help with what they're looking for. As opposed to your typical cocktail party. I went to one for CFOs the other day. And, you know, I spoke with the person to my left. I spoke to the person to my right. I spoke at the thing during the cocktail party. I spoke to two other people. There were like 100 people in the room. Only 5% of them had a chance to help me. Shift the dynamics. You shift what's possible.
Shifting the dynamic, I love that. I alluded to this in the introduction. You are a designer and you think about how to make and facilitate these shifts. Mm-hmm. Could you highlight some of those key aspects that are different than that networking event where you only talk to the person to your left and right? You sound like you did some very deliberate things there that helped.
I did. Yeah. I did. I worked with an amazing professional facilitator named Misha Globerman over many months to start to work through this, and with a guy who does some other really amazing events named John Levy, to start to think through this. And so it's not really a networking event in the way that you think, where like we're going to talk about, like, here's my business card, here's your business card, like, talk at the surface. You know, oftentimes, you know, once you start seeing the need for help on the wall and you start, you know, you get introduced to some people, right? What you see all of a sudden is that people stop talking about, you know, I'm fundraising. That's actually not allowed in these conversations, right? That's one of the few rules. It's like, no, you can't talk about, you can't ask for people for money. And people talk about, you know, I need help. You know, my kid's having trouble. How do I help them? You know, I'm stuck in my career. I'm looking for a new trajectory. How have you thought about that? And when you start there at the human level, right, the business level takes care of itself. Because at the end of the day, right, I don't want to do transactional business. Because A, I don't think it's particularly effective. You don't get kind of the order of magnitude growth through transactional business. But also, like, why would you do that in your life? Right. Every time I've taken on a new job, I've added, you know, 100%, 200% is zero to my salary. And it hasn't been because I like went on LinkedIn and started looking for jobs. It's been because of somebody I met 5 years ago or 10 years ago or 20 years ago. And my ability to do something new reliably that they know I uniquely can do. So how do you shift from being transactional to being strategic in your life?
And that sounds like it really addresses a number one thing I hear with my coaching when we talk about networking and more about building relationships is that, oh, this is so transactional. And so in a way, you're kind of making that kind of transactional part go away, tapping into this need we all have for connection and wanting to help others. Is that a way to think about it?
100%. And it's, you know, it's a little bit about intention, right? Like I don't tell people too much about what's going to happen, and it's a weird thing, and it's in some place, you know, and you're not going to meet people you know, you know. And so kind of people self-select, right? They self-select for interesting and curious. And so you end up with people who are willing to go there with you. I think the other piece of it is, we set it up so that we ask people, you know, what are you looking for? You know, what's the change you're looking for before they get there? And so oftentimes we'll have, you know, all of the requests, literally I'll spend like 3 hours and I'll write them up on a giant whiteboard, billboard, and put them on the wall so that we have an easy way for people to just say, hey, call me, you know, or whatever, you know, on the board so that you don't even have to have the conversation about that thing. It just kind of takes care of itself, you know. The second thing we do is we don't let people get in groups of more than three or four. And if they're in a group, you know, cavorting with their friends for too long, we tend to try and break them up. I don't always succeed at this, but I really dislike bringing couples. Because they often they're magnets and they close off the shape of the conversation. Even if I like the couple, right? It's just a part of the dynamic that can be challenging. So those are some of the things we do to try and make it open, Right. So it's not about facilitating in terms of like, I am at the front of the room and we will now do this. It's about creating a structure in which that facilitation naturally happens.
You've run a lot of these. As they've occurred, is there anything that's surprised you or that you actually changed in the design?
Yeah. I mean, every time it evolves, you know, and it's really about how do you create what's necessary for the group, right? Like the second it's about me, it's not useful, right? To the extent it's about the people in the room, like they feel it and it gets authentic. And I think that's the first thing. The second thing is instantly making people comfortable, right? Like making sure there's always someone at the door to welcome them and to invite them, to introduce them to the first person, and making sure that's a good connection. It's someone that person will enjoy, right? It's like the secret game of like putting the right people next to the right people at the wedding banquet. Once you get past that first one, now you got friends, right? It's a safe space and people really open up. And what I've found is that, you know, people mistake introversion for shyness, right? There are a lot of people like me who are relatively extroverted, but historically shy and don't want to, uncomfortable just saying hello to a random stranger. The question is always, how do you create a room of friends? Mm.
That's it in a nutshell.
Yeah.
And also this show, we talk a lot about, you know, we geek out a little bit on the social science. You have talked about this deep need we have all have for connection, a lot of research on that, mm-hmm. that we actually do want to help most mm-hmm. people, given all that's going on in the world.
If it's easy and it's not about you, right? We are almost always doing something for a bigger purpose, right? For our kids, for our businesses, for our country, for our religion, for our community, right? Obviously, sometimes it's often going to benefit us, and like hiding that isn't cool. But we don't really necessarily want to help people who are helping themselves. Mm. We almost always want to help somebody who's trying to do something bigger. If it's easy and there's very little political risk, and the things that are easy for me are hard for other people. Same thing the other way around. You know, I had this amazing conversation with Adam Grant, who was kind enough to blurb my book. And I was like, Adam, thank you so much. What can I do to help? And he said, you know, like, here's the deal. I've been where you are. I have gone beyond my wild expectations. I don't need help with anything. What I want you to do is help someone else. And I think that once we get to a certain point in our careers, that need shifts, right? Where we move from needing to be of service. Mm. And the question is, how do we do that in the most productive way? Right. If it's a 8-hour conversation with you about the meaning of life and your children, probably not going to do that. If it's a 3-minute email and I'm confident that you'll actually be useful and you'll follow through and that there will be an outcome that's bigger than you, I'm probably going to do that. Mm. And so it's a question of framing the request so that I can help. And I just wanted to be really careful when you talked about most of us want to help. We do. But we want to maximize the leverage of our time.
Right.
And that's not a greedy thing. That's about being selfless, right? How do we give the most in the world with our time and our effort?
So, Jonathan, these serendipity events, I don't know if you're still running them or do they just kind of pop up? Like if someone says, hey, that's super cool, how do I get on Jonathan's list or how do I find out about them? Because I had linked to the previous one you had sent me and the pages disappeared. I've gone into the ether. I mean, it sounds like a fantastic thing.
Yeah.
A lot of people would want to be part of it. I mean, how do they find out?
So if it's a thing you're trying to do in your organization, jonathanbrill.com, and there's a link in there, I believe, to Serendipity Salons. If you are an individual and you're interested, reach out to me on LinkedIn, right? Connect with me on LinkedIn. That's kind of where I find people because I'm, you know, I'm in 40 cities a year. And so that's the only way I can track who's where.
And for those who cannot attend, as you've also worked with tons of individuals and have seen how people network or build deeper relationships, anything that you want to just suggest to people in terms of how they spend their time, obviously going to an event like this is great, but a subtle shift they ought to think about, an important one that would dramatically increase the effectiveness of their relationship building or networking.
Invite the people you want to dinner. It is really stunning who will come. And if your goal isn't to sell them something, right? Because powerful people, they get sold at all day long. No one wants your direct messages on LinkedIn. But if you're coming to it from, hey, I'm in town. I'm bringing together some interesting people. I think you're interesting. Would you like to meet some other people who don't suck? A lot of them will come. You'd be stunned.
This very much taps into this, these weak ties, unexpected connections. You had mentioned you don't want to become the center. Being the organizer, there is the satisfaction of connecting all these people and helping them. You know, in kind of networking theory too, there is an advantage if you are kind of the hub that links other people, a super connector. What kind of benefits have you also experienced from this? I mean, I imagine then a lot of people know that they met each other through Jonathan's events or know Jonathan.
Yeah. There's a, you know, I've spoken with Dory about this, right? She does a similar thing when she travels. And, you know, the interesting thing is that you don't necessarily get invited to other people's parties because you invite people to yours. I think part of that is in a post-COVID world, we're just not throwing enough parties. And so just do it. The other insight has been that the benefits are not direct, right? So what I've found is I can ask for help on behalf of someone else, right? I've got a colleague with this energy, smart energy company, doesn't know how to solve this challenge. I think it's useful. Would you be willing to, you know, give him a few minutes of your time and see if you can make a phone call? That works really well. Hi, I'm Jonathan. I want money. Because I know a lot of people, that does not work really well. But random people appear in my life. Wonderful people like you, Michael, appear in my life. And that is the benefit of what happens. It is not a projectable future. It's about people inviting you into their lives because you invited them into yours. And it's 1 in 100, right? It's 1 in 1,000. You never know. And it's about being good in the world for me. It's a values thing. You know, one of the things I did discover, you asked me about, you know, what's changed in how I do this. I used to think I needed to have a special event venue and it had to be some big shiny thing and so on and so forth, or I had to have it at my house and cook a 36 course meal. And I still love doing all of those things, but you can also just invite 20 people out for flapjacks, right? Like, you don't even need to pay for it. In fact, it's better if you don't pay for it. It's better if they actually put $100 in or $50 in or $10 in or $1 in, because then they know what the agenda is. And more powerful people will actually come if they pay for the thing than if it's free.
Jonathan, you're also a tech futurist. You are out in Silicon Valley. And so, of course, virtual world, we were all forced to do a lot of that with COVID that generated kind of interesting thinking in different ways. And now everything's a Zoom and virtual worlds and avatars. And but to me, there's still no substitute for the in-person. How did that force some of your thinking, or are there ways that you can best replicate in the virtual environment this type of experience, or flat out can't do it?
You know, I'm an inhuman human. For me, you know, COVID was really difficult. And now I travel pretty much every week. You know, we were just having a discussion before the podcast, and we discovered that I was in Madrid and I didn't reach out to Michael, and apparently he was somewhere else. But like, I was there because, you know, my friend just moved there. And like, I find that the amount of value and change you create in person, you know, both as a speaker, I do a lot of keynote speaking, and as an advisor, it's an order of magnitude. You know, the efficiency of business development is an order of magnitude greater in person than it is online. You know, as an author during COVID, right, I'd do these podcasts or book things or whatever online, and, you know, 100 people would show up and no one would buy a book. You know, when I do them in person, 100 people show up and 100 people take a book. Mm. Like that's the difference. It's a different, the ability to build trust may be there online, but the ability to transact is not there.
The inhuman human. Love it.
You've been listening to 97% Effective with your host, executive coach Michael Winderoth. If this interview is making you think, make sure to share it with a friend. Now, back to our interview.
We're not going to go in depth into your book, but I recommend everyone read it. It's immensely practical and frameworks for thinking about navigating uncertainty and how you can make subtle shifts to ride through disruption, ride the waves, as I said in the introduction. My question here, because I deal a lot with individuals in companies, Jonathan, you advise companies and the leaders, although certainly work with individuals themselves. As I was reading your book and thinking about the interview, there's a lot of overlaps here too, in terms of how we think about our careers as individuals. Mm-hmm. And I did want to ask you, because helping organizations and leaders navigate uncertainty, you get a thing that gets thrown into the wrench where there's organizational dynamics. And great that the company does well, but oftentimes certain individuals, you know, may not get that benefit because someone takes credit, they get overlooked. How do we make sure also that, like, the people who are contributing to this great whole also get rewarded? Because a lot of the times, especially in my line of work, they don't. And that's why they come work with me of how do I make sure I don't get steamrolled by someone else? You've been in big companies, you work with them. Particular thoughts or views on how individuals should also take care of themselves in organizations?
Well, I think with OpenAI, you know, what we've seen is this world of 10 little Indians, right? There's this Agatha Christie book where, you know, 10 folks end up on an island and one by one they all die. Well, there were 11 founders of OpenAI. 10 are no longer there, I believe. And Sam Altman, it turns out, is the undertaker. How did Sam Altman survive when the people who actually did the work did not? Right? How did the CEO survive when the people who actually did the work did not? And a lot of it is that he understood it's a political game, right? He associated himself with the money. He associated himself with the points of control. He made himself invaluable to those points of control. What we see when we look at network dynamics, the most networked people in the company are not necessarily those who survive huge challenges. What we see, research by Tony O'Driscoll at Duke, has found that about 25% of the high performers in companies are not recognized by the companies because they're high performing instead of peacocking.
Right.
You know, it's really important to do that work. It's part of the job. And, you know, a lot of people like to pretend it's not. Like, in some ways, it is the job, right? As you move from being an executional leader, right? Like, what hill should we go up to an operational leader? I'm sorry, an executional leader. Let's go up the hill to an operational leader. What hill should we go up to a strategic leader asking why should we go up that hill in the first place, right? Like, the jobs change. And what we miss as executional leaders is that when you move into that operational role, it's increasingly a political role. It's about getting things done between functions. It's about visibility. It's about all of those things, you know, and being good and getting things done, but also unlocking for other people. How do you make sure that you get credit for not for doing other people's work, but for unlocking other people's potential? Because that's really, I think, what creates the value, not actually doing it yourself. That's an executional leader role. But it's also what creates the power.
Yeah.
Right? Because if you're the person who unlocks for other people, man, people kind of want you around. And if people know that you do that, if the strategic leaders know that you do that, then you're high value.
And is that as simple, Jonathan, as, you know, you kind of said you have to do a little of the peacocking, right? Is that as simple as pointing out, hey, I'm unlocking this, or these individuals, kind of highlighting their accomplishments, that you had something to do with that, you facilitated it? Or are there more subtle or other strategies that you think people should embrace?
I think it's very dependent on the culture, right? Like, so going into HP, you know, it's kind of a culture where, you know, it you know, at Microsoft, it's all about how big I am, right? And at HP, that kind of culture doesn't exist there. They don't like it. It's a very Australian culture in some ways and very Spanish culture in some ways, right? There are the leaders. The leaders are the leaders. But the people going up the ranks are supposed to kind of be team players and workers. And so peacocking in the way that you would at Microsoft really doesn't work, I discovered. But what I did discover was that showing how you are tied to growth and how you are tied to growing other people is in fact highly valued. So how do you do that? Right? Like, I think it's really about, you know, no one likes a middle manager that's always talking about stuff and doing nothing and trying to trade cards they don't have. Like, no one likes that person. I'm not suggesting that you do that, but figuring out how you can unlock for other people, you know, that's the opportunity, and reminding those other people to tell your boss that you unlocked for them. Mm-hmm. Right. That's often the thing is like, hey, yeah, thank you so much. Here's the thing. If it was useful, the thing that would be useful to me is just tell my boss I was useful.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Or tell my boss's boss I was useful or tell, right. Like, make sure it gets back like two levels above. Right, because I can't go to. Here's the answer to the question. I'm sorry, it took a few moments to get there. If you're helping someone else, they can tell someone two levels above you that you were useful. You can't do that. It costs them nothing to do that for you. Nothing. That's the kind of high value help that we can easily provide for each other.
I'd say everyone out there listening, you know, think about someone who has been great in your organization, who has done that, sing their praises, right? There's the number one tip I say on kind of self-promotion is someone else promoting you, particularly those with, you know, influence, but those who are speaking to those who, you know, have power and don't necessarily see those things.
And they can just do it, right? They can just send an email. They don't even need to know the person. Say, hey, you know, I was talking to this guy in your org. He was really helpful today. Thank you so much. Right. That helps them. That helps you. It increases their visibility. It increases yours.
Yeah. So these are very practical things that, you know, individuals we can do to help ourselves, to help others. Obviously, we're thinking of kind of the greater good than the greater outcomes we're trying to achieve as a team. You also obviously work and consult with organizations and with leaders. And I had a few months back Don Moore over at Berkeley come on. We were talking about designing. Right? He wants us to think much more about design in terms of leadership, in terms of how you structure things and so forth. So I'd ask you also the same question as you're advising leaders and organizations, because you talk a lot about culture in your book, Shaping the Culture, and you just alluded to it there. You know, again, what are simple things that leaders or organizations can implement, design into their culture that enables also the good to come out and to eliminate some of the nasty organizational politics?
Well, I mean, it's hard to eliminate organizational politics. It's part of it. It's once you realize it's a game, then it's a lot easier. But it's a painful process to realize it's just a game. But once you do, it's just like with your kids, right? If you get caught up in their emotional lives instead of realizing that it's just a dynamic and you're there to help. Yeah, it gets really frustrating. But once you realize, hey, they're going through the things six-year-olds go through, and I don't need to respond, right? They can be helpful, but I don't need to respond. Once you realize that with your kids, like, life gets a lot easier. Same thing with your business, right? Once you realize that these politics are, it's a game, it gets fun. I got yelled at by my sister for telling her that, by the way. Like, I totally get it if you're on this road. She also figured it out, and she's now doing really, really, really well as a mid-level executive.
That maps also to a former guest on the podcast, former client of mine at Scientific Games, Kashav Patani. He's been on this podcast as well. And when he did that reframe and we worked on that, he's like, oh, it's just what I do. I create games. I keep people engaged. And when he thought of it and reframed it that way, to your point exactly, organizational politics didn't necessarily become such a mind-numbing thing that annoyed him.
That's fun.
And enables you.
Fun.
Yeah.
It was not always fun because they didn't understand the rules.
Yeah.
But yeah, once you figure it out, it's fun.
So what can leaders do, though?
First thing, there are, I think, two sets of research we've done on this. The first is kind of how do you build a culture that thrives? And it's really about thinking about your incentives is a senior leader, right? As a strategic leader, it's thinking about your incentive structures, right? What are you doing to incentivize people to leverage help? Right. Most of the time we're disincentivizing it, right? This function shouldn't talk to that function because we're tracking this KPI or that KPI. And it's not intentional, right? But you disincentivize it, or you only incentivize it going up or down a silo. Where do the incentives encourage people to leverage help? The second is, you know, in a world particularly of artificial intelligence that we're moving into in the next several years, right? Not necessarily today, but in the next couple of years. What we're going to see is all of the data in the organization, everybody can access. And so what are you doing to encourage people to make unexpected connections? Find information that's not in the system, because that's where the new value is, right? The third piece is about controlling chaos. So much of what we've learned in scientific management is that you use standard operating procedures and you get standard results. Really good. Not saying we shouldn't do that. We should totally do that. But we're moving into a world of increasing disruption, a world of increasing commoditization. And so what we need to do is figure out how we're going to work with that disruption and create non-standard, deviant opportunities. And the way you do that is by teaching your people not to manage risk through standard operating procedures, but figure out when you're in non-standard times. That requires that people start thinking about, from a first principles perspective, about risk and opportunity. How should we manage it in this case, as opposed to assuming this case is like the last one? And when you do that, you can have really incredible results. I was on Sunday with a guy named Joe Connell, who's runs a major marine salvage outfit, right? So if you hear like oil spills, submarines, you know, that sunk under the ocean, like whatever, he's the guy they call. He does the most dangerous stuff on Earth. And in 40 years, no one has ever died on a job. Not because he has standard operating procedures. Yes, he has those. But when you're taking apart a cargo ship with chainsaws and removing it, you know, 2,000 pounds at a time with a helicopter, because you can't get ships to this crazy reef, right? There are no rules. You've got to think from a first principles perspective about how am I going to do that? And what people like that have proven to me is when you do that, you can actually do it safely. You can do the most dangerous things on the planet safely the first time. The last piece is about taking the time to know what's missing. So we talked about leveraging help and unexpected connections. We talked about controlling chaos. The last piece is about knowing what's missing, taking the time to not just focus on what's there, but to focus on what's not there. Because those are the places where the new pools of value are. Those are the places where the new opportunities are. And so how are we going to lean into that? Because in a world of once again, AI and these machine learning tools, the stuff we have data about, everybody will have data about. The question is, are we going to find value? Are we going to find new opportunities, new ways of doing things in the places where there are holes? So when you leverage help, unexpected connections, you control chaos, you know what's missing. You have this kind of consultant acronym, LOC.
There you go.
But you also have an ability to make it much more strategic in your life.
Jonathan, I wanted to preserve a little bit of time here because I had some very personal questions for you. You've shown you're a deep thinker. And how does one become, right, the futurist? It was funny because on the plane ride back home, Emily Chang interviews Brian Chesky, and Mm-hmm. And it's funny because as I was preparing for this interview, it got me thinking. He was also a Pratt. He started as an artist and then industrial design. And
yeah,
it's kind of similar to your background. You didn't start as a management, you know, studying business.
To clarify, when I was at HP, they made me go to Stanford because I had no business training. And they're like, you're talking to the C-suite and you're advising stuff around board issues. You need to actually know the words. So it was very late in life that I got the business training.
And that helped you learn the words.
I had all of the parts to the UFO. I just didn't have the construction manual.
Yeah.
And it was incredibly helpful.
Yeah. Say what kind of Pratt and an industrial design background. You were at Frog and other places. I saw that.
Yeah.
What is different about that thinking, and how has that helped you get to where you're at? It's quite interesting. And I think people should know more about that.
So my dad's best friend was a guy named Steve Caney, and he was an inventor. And so he invented toys. And so I just always assumed that you could just kind of like come up with new stuff and make a real good living doing it. And you could just do whatever the heck you wanted. And he was an industrial designer by training. And so I was like, I want to do that. That looks like a lot more fun than accounting. And so I've always had this bent that it's the way, you know, what I do, what I think the best industrial designers do is they don't just put shape to an object. They find a new way to solve a problem, right? They find new value. They focus on that question of like knowing what's missing that we were talking about before. It's not just like, how do we make it prettier, right? How do we change the color of the Ferrari? It's like, okay, well, like how do we make Airbnb, right? How do we make a new way, a new economic market, or change the economic market, change the economic rules in this product category? And so I think that's what Brian did. It took him several years to figure out that's what he was doing, and then it started working. I think starting off as an artist, you know, is really important because, you know, you start with the blank canvas, right? You never know what you're making before you start. As a sculptor, right? You start with the marble or the clay, and you never know what you're making before you start. And you have to be confident that you're going to make something at the end, and you build an intuition, right? A systemic intuition about how to do that. And at the end of the day, I think it comes back to those first three things in the luck paradigm, right? One, leveraging help. I have no idea what success looks like. I have no idea how to get there. And starting with that and like the customer interviewing process, incredibly important. Unexpected connections, right? Like if we know, and this scares the bejesus out of product managers and project managers, if we know what we're making before we make it, we aren't going to make a breakthrough product. We can make a reliable product. We can get reliable growth, but we aren't going to get outsized growth, and we're not going to outperform the market. So how do you make those unexpected connections? Well, you can't do that. You can't take those kinds of risks unless you're looking at a first principles basis. Like, how do you control chaos? How do you control danger? How do you turn those disruptions into opportunities? Because at the end of the day, if you want to charge excess rents, if you want excess margin, you have to be able to safely do things, reliably do things that other people can't touch. So we were talking about Joe Connell. Like, why does he have his own jet? Joe Connell has his own jet because he is the only guy on the planet who can safely take apart a tanker on a reef with a helicopter. And like, if you need to do that, there's one guy who knows how to do it safely. And you don't want to get that. You don't want to hire the guy who's just gonna, you know, wing it. He doesn't wing it, even though he doesn't know how he's going to do it. Mm. I think that's the industrial design, the inventor mindset. And I think that's what's so compelling to us about, you know, industrial designers, inventors, in many cases, special operators, right? Navy SEALs, right? As they get put into these incredibly dangerous situations where the standard operating procedures don't work, and where standard ways of doing and assuming that you know the answer before you get there will inevitably result in failure.
Well, if there was a man in a mindset for the time that we live in of massive disruption, it's you, Jonathan. So I thank you for your contributions.
So I want to just drop an up note here, because I thought that last bit was a little scary, and then go there. So what can you do to get your company future-oriented, to get your group future-oriented, to get your next meeting future-oriented, right? Because this isn't scary stuff. It's a mindset stuff, right? It's not innately dangerous or scary. It's about having the mindset and the craft to safely get from one place to another. And the things you can do, the reasons I think companies fail to see the future, fail to do the powerful thing, is that they get caught in three conundrums. And if you just call them out in a meeting, people can start to talk about it, right? The first is, I think we often look through binoculars instead of using a radar, right? Our KPIs, our incentives, our stressors all get us looking at the information in front of us instead of the information around us, particularly true in performance-oriented, process-oriented groups. We often see organizations that suffer from the elephant problem, right? These are typically highly matrixed organizations, mature organizations, right? Someone's looking at the tassel on the tail, someone's looking at the four legs, someone's looking at the tusks, someone's looking at the trunk, but no one's stepping back to say there's an elephant in the room. If you ask, you know, are we doing one of these things? Because I guarantee you, based on every workshop I've ever done, you are. Or you ask, where are we fighting the last war, right? The one we know how to win instead of the one that we'll face. Because when I look at how companies allocate budget, it is inevitably about trying to avoid the thing that got us in trouble the last time, the thing that got the last guy fired, the thing that pissed off regulators, as opposed to the thing that we don't know how to do, we don't know how to solve. Those are the real risks. And we focus on the false ones. So when we start shifting the perspective from looking at the present to asking about the future, where are we using binoculars instead of radar? Where do we suffer from the elephant problem? And where are we fighting the last war? We shift the dynamic. And you don't need to be a CEO to do this. You don't need to be an executive to do this. You can do this in every single meeting. And when you do that, you look damn smart, and it gives someone an opportunity to email your boss's boss to say that guy's thinking strategically.
So being future-oriented, mindset, it's a mindset.
Yeah.
And like you said, you can do this in every meeting.
Absolutely. You don't need to be the boss to ask a good question.
Yeah. Yeah.
And none of those are challenging questions. They're opening questions. They are challenging questions, but they're opening questions. It's real hard to shut them down.
Yeah.
And it's real hard to blame you for doing it.
Yeah.
So what is a good book is what you were asking.
Yeah, because you're always continually thinking about, you know, being future oriented, challenging yourself. And so curious as to what you're looking at now, what's shifted your thinking in the past.
Yeah. So I think, you know, one of the big challenges that we have is executional and operational leaders is that we aren't looking at the bigger picture. We're disincentivized to it by it or to look at it. And yet if we don't understand the frame in which our organization is operating, we don't have the ability to take advantage of it. So the biggest, earliest, first, most boring thing that you can do is read your company's annual report. If you're a public company in the US, it's called the 10K. It's published to the SEC, and what you want to look at is section 1A. What are the strategic risks in your organization? When you start looking at those things, that's what your leadership actually cares about. It's not growth, it's failure. And if you understand where they're prioritizing, you can actually make strategic recommendations. Most people don't do that. I know this because I run a lot of workshops, and if you're below the senior vice president level, you probably just glossed past that section. It's the important one. The second thing that I think is important for understanding the world as it will be is understanding the facts, understanding structurally what's happening. So there's this great book, I just happen to have it here, called Factfulness by Hans Rosling. It's a couple years old now, but it kind of talks about the macro trends on the planet and what's true versus what's in the headlines. I guess it's 5 years old. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of at the edge of its usefulness, but a great book. There's another book called How the World Really Works by Vaclav Smil. Okay. So this is Bill Gates' favorite author. Mm. Excellent book on understanding the economics that actually drive our planet. When you understand that, a whole lot that seems random starts to become obvious.
Jonathan, fantastic to have you on. I've waited much too long to make this connection. Deep thinking, but very practical. It's the way I feel about your book too. You know, having been in the seat in many different innovative companies, working with executives who are, it is a great practical guide. Like you said, it is a mindset that you can embrace and bring in. And clearly, this is the things that help your own career as well.
Well, and it's about stuff that's obvious after the fact. You know, it's an attempt to put together the way you do impossible things in a book. You know, I was talking about Joe earlier, the salvage guy, and I was talking with him about it in the frameworks, and he was like, yeah, that's all obvious, except it's not. I wish somebody had written that down for me.
It's all obvious, except it's not. Yeah. So on that note, the show notes are going to have all the links to your work and your website. Other ways that people reach out, connect, see your work?
Find me on LinkedIn. I'm always there. I try and be there every day. And then my website, jonathanbrill.com.
Yeah. Jonathan Brill, business futurist, transformation architect, author of Rogue Waves. Absolute pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Wonderful to see you, Michael.
Thanks for listening to 97% Effective, where we skip happy talk and help you break through and ascend one hard truth at a time. Help others discover this show. Leave a review and rating wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you like what you heard, you can get free resources, including the first chapters of Michael's book, Get Promoted, on his website, www.changwinderoth.com. That's www.changwenderoth.com.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.